Welcome to Cashflow Positive. I'm your host, Kenny Bedwell, founder of SCR Insights, one of the leading data platforms in the industry. Through using data and analytics, I've been able to replace my W-2 with cash flow from my successful short-term rentals. And my goal is to help you achieve the same freedom and success. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just a novice looking to make your mark, Cashflow Positive is your go-to resource for unlocking the full potential of your property portfolio. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Cashflow Positive. My name is Kenny Bedwell, and we're going to be talking about mortgage fraud today, which is kind of scary because that's a federal offense, and you can actually go to jail for that. And I wanted to bring in an expert in lending, someone who has the nickname the short-term rental loan genie or mortgage genie. So she knows a lot about lending and even short-term rentals. She has over 12 short-term rentals. She does loans across 43 states all around the country. Personal friend of mine, awesome, awesome person as well. The one, the only, Parker Borowski. Welcome to the show. Parker, tell us more about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm two things, two big things, a lot of things, but two big things. So I am a very experienced investor. My husband and I own and operate 12 short-term rental properties between Tennessee, the Smoky Mountains, and the Panhandle of Florida. And we've been doing that since 2018, so for quite some time now. And then also my passion and my superpower happens to be lending for short-term rentals. And so I have a team and we specialize in short-term rental lending. We can do primary homes too and all that good stuff. But the majority of what we do is short-term rentals in 43 states across the country. We do conventional, jumbo, DSCR, and some other non-QM products too, which I think have gained and will continue to gain more popularity. So, yeah.
Okay. Like what? I want to know what they are.
Good question. So, yeah. So bank statement loans, I think, go unused. And yep. I'm actually doing one right now. So on paper, this client makes, like, if we look at tax returns, they're making like $5,000 a month.
They're but poor.
With the bank statement. Yes. Right. Yeah. It's like you can buy a tin box.
Yeah.
And, but with the bank statement loans, it's $40,000 a month. So we can, and we can use that for this particular one is buying a primary home, going that route. They're a real estate investor. They've purchased some properties within the last year. They just don't have a lot of rental income showing yet for them, for those properties, when they're renovating. So it's not even on the rental market yet. And they wanted to buy a new primary. So this bank statement was a great route to go with them. But we can also use bank statements for investment property, to purchase investment or second homes. So the bank statement's not just for primary. So that's a good one. We also have a full doc non-QM loan. And I think the full doc non-QM really go overlooked because, sure, they're full doc, I know, a little bit annoying, but they have more lenient guidelines in how we can look at income. So one of our full doc non-QM loans, when it comes to rental income, actually allows us to take 12 months gross rental income from your properties, hit it, we can do 80% and use that versus your tax return rental income. So that can make a huge difference.
How is that different than a DSCR loan?
Well, so it's still debt to income ratio based, the full doc.
Oh, okay. So it's still based on your income. Okay. Mm-hmm.
It just gives us more lenient ways to look at your income. And we can combine different things. And so this is why sometimes I've been called the loan genie, the loan magician, whatever, right? But really, it comes from a knowledge of understanding how to put these loans together and how to best use them for people. Plus some good convincing skills with underwriters and understanding guidelines and reading them and really looking into them. That's where that skill set comes from. But so, for example, this non-QM product, let's say you have someone who's self-employed, maybe they own a marketing business, right? So they own a marketing business. They don't show a lot on paper, but they are generating some pretty good gross income. Of course, they don't show a lot on paper. That's the game, right? You want to not show that you have a lot of income on paper. And let's say they bought two short-term rentals last February. Right. So they haven't done their 24 taxes yet. But let's say they also inherited $200,000 a couple of years ago from an aunt that passed away. And they want to purchase a $1.2 million property. So a few ways we can do this if we needed to get them qualified from a debt to income ratio perspective. So we could do with these non-QM products, we can definitely do 1 year tax returns. Maybe that they have a new marketing business and 2 years ago it was terrible, but the most recent tax return is much better. So we can use the most recent year tax return filed. And then regarding their rental properties they bought last February, we can get the 12-month gross rental history and use 80% of that as income to wipe out those payments, probably give them some additional positive revenue. And then if we had to add there's asset depletion. So we could take that, if they weren't going to use that $200,000, maybe they have other money for the down payment, right? Maybe that $200,000 is just going to sit there. We can divide that by 60 months and use that amount as monthly income. So with these non-QM loans, you can put all these little pieces together to create a pretty interesting debt to income ratio qualifying scenario. This is why I tell people don't DIY your DTI. Don't DIY your DTI because you don't know all the products out there. A lot of loan originators don't know all the products. There's probably products I don't even know about that are out there.
Yeah. I think it's important to like for a lot of people to speak to lenders, different lenders. A lot of people, I see a lot of people they come from purchasing primary residences, maybe long-term rentals, and they had some guy at some bank that they local and they had a relationship with. And they come to me and they're like, this is the guy I'm using. These are the terms. And I'm like, these are awful.
Yeah.
I'm like, if he's your friend, like, you know, you need to, you know, reevaluate that. And then it's probably, you know, like he's not trying to, you know, get one over on anybody. It's just what they have, what they offer. And so I think it's really important to find lenders who understand, like, who have different options available. So. And that's kind of what I want to talk about. One of the topics of many topics that I wanted to talk with you about today. So first off, let's get into the interesting ones. That's the hot topic, the hot button. Okay. There's two big things. We'll do two sections here. There's two big topics that are just everyone's talking about it, at least I see on social media. Let's start with the big one. And this is one that I've referenced too, and I've been getting more and more education on in terms of like understanding things I know and then things that, you know, are it's becoming kind of really, really gray. And that's with seller credits. So first, there's two terms, and I still see people mess up the difference between them. So seller credits and seller concessions. There's a lot of confusion between the two. Can you tell us from a lending standpoint, what's the difference between seller credits and seller concessions?
As far as I'm aware, there is no difference.
Well, in terms of like the separate addendum, getting money back at the closing table that goes towards a contractor, maybe it's even furnishing credits or things like that, or towards maintenance or repair.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's not allowed on our end from a lending perspective.
So what is allowed? Let's start with that.
No, people aren't going to like this, but technically, all that's allowed from a lending perspective is the max that the sellers can contribute towards the purchase is the either a percent, depending on the loan type you're getting, sometimes, you know, at 2% or 6% of the lesser of whatever that restriction is, or the actual closing cost, prepaids, and points. And that's it. When you start getting into things like, so here's a simple example. Let's say you don't like the color of the walls and you want them to paint the color of the wall, the paint the walls, right? That is considered an inducement to purchase. And the guidelines state if there is an inducement to purchase, we are supposed to reduce the purchase price by that number. So if there is a concession that we're aware of that, you know, let's say you're getting $50,000 to renovate, whatever, right? If you're getting $50,000 to renovate and we're aware of it, the guidelines are that we have to reduce the purchase price by that $50,000.
Right.
So you can get it, but that's how we're supposed to respond to it. So if you want the technical loan guidelines for these products, that's what they say.
Right. So I think what's really important here and how I see things, like, so with seller concessions, especially, it's a percentage and it's a set percentage up to, depending on the loan type, to, like Parker was saying, to, I think sometimes 3, maybe 6%. It depends on the loan type, right? And the way that I've seen banks use it is they call it, you know, you use it or lose it. So it can only go towards, like, all the things that you mentioned, basically like closing costs. I had a situation where I had some seller concessions, and I think it was like 2% or something. And, you know, the taxes were really low on the property. The closing costs were like virtually zero. And they were calling me like, they're like, we have all this money. We're going to lose this this concession. What can we use this on? And so I ended up paying my HOA dues for 2 years. Got the appraisal paid for. We did a survey, got that paid for, my inspection paid for, all my closing costs, 100% paid for all the concessions, but it was use it or lose it type of situation. And that wasn't, any of that money can't come into my pocket. And I think that that has been the issue. Now, with credits, we see credits more as like, hey, Mr. Seller, like you were mentioning, like the painting the wall thing, and we'll get into this. This is where it gets gray, you know, but like something is broken on the property that you think the seller should probably fix or should have fixed, but maybe you don't trust them to fix it right. That's where I see a lot of like opportunity for seller credits, where it's like, hey, I've got a quote from a contract. This is really, really important for people listening here. You have a quote from a contractor for X amount, and that's what the credit is for. So, for example, I'm buying a hotel in New Orleans, and we did a sewer scope where they just take a camera of some sort and stick it down the sewer. And so... Anyway, they found like some leak or something, and they're like, yes, this is going to be $15,000. You know, here's the quote. Here's everything to do it. I go to the seller. I say, look, you are giving me a credit. And the lender actually knows about this credit. You're giving me a credit to fix this, but the lender is only lending on the amount. Like you said, they drop the purchase price and they're only lending on that amount. They're not lending on that full amount. And so that's the really important thing, is when the lender knows about a credit of some sort, whatever amount, they're supposed to legally, the loan amount is supposed to drop based on the purchase price. So anyway, what else would you like to add to that?
Well, see, and here's where you open up the can of worms. So something like that, we still don't want to know about, right? If you're going to handle something on the back end, that's cool. The reason we don't want to know about that is because then it comes into question, well, what's wrong with the sewer line? Now there's a problem with the property.
Yep.
Right? And now the lender... Yeah. And now, especially some of these, so people think DSCR loans and these non-QM stuff are easy. They're not that easy. And they're more picky about the property and condition of the property because it's a riskier loan product, right? There's a higher default rate on DSCR loans than there are conventional loans. That's why the rates are higher and the risk is higher. It's a riskier loan product. So they're a little pickier. So if something like that comes to light, or a foundation issue, you know, if you have a credit for something like that, that could cause a problem too. So that's one of those things. And that's where you legitimately, and this is something where, you know, you want to talk to the title company, right? As the agents want to talk to the title company and square that away. Like, hey, the seller's agreed to fix, do the, you know, $15,000, right? That's something that the lender, we don't need to be aware of that. Well, I don't know if we should or shouldn't be. You probably don't want us to be aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So when it comes to seller credits, what I tell people, it's not you're trying to deceive your lender. It's if you involve your lender, they're going to tell you, and then they might not be able to even give you a loan based on what you're trying to do, because it could bring in extra attention issues that weren't originally there from a lending standpoint. So it is be careful with that.
And can I say one more thing on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I'm a why person, right? So I think some people listening might help people wrap their heads around why. Like, well, hey, well, if I get the seller to agree to give me $50,000 towards a renovation or $100,000 towards a renovation, why does the lender care? Right? So, and that can go a couple of ways. The reason you can't receive cash at closing is because then you haven't met the minimum contribution. So for example, DSCR loans, right? At 20% down, minimum down payment. So all these lending terms are based on the buyer putting 20% down, hopefully of their own money, right? Their skin in the game. So there's buy-in there. Well, if you were to get money back at closing, there's no guarantee that you're going to use that money to fix anything on the property. And now you haven't met the 20% down. You haven't put 20% of your own money in because now you're getting money back. And so you totally defeat the purpose of the loan to value and the money in. And so that's why getting cash back at closing beyond closing cost prepays and points is a huge problem on the lending side.
I mean, let's call a spade a spade. I mean, that's considered mortgage fraud.
True. Yep, absolutely. It is.
I love that we got to this topic, Parker. I forgot. I'll let you kind of do your thing, but you were like, sit back, hair behind the ears. You're like, this is, yeah, let's go like this, because it's a hot topic. It really is. And I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. So obviously you can't take seller credits and get them back to your name. Like you just said, the $50,000 come back to you. But I do want to circle back and highlight something I hear a lot. And this is the gray area with this. Seller credits, $50,000, but it's going towards a designer who's technically a contractor of some sort, who's going to redesign the property and add amenities to the property that will equal to or more, you know, we'll say equal to $50,000. You know, obviously from a lending standpoint, you can't know about that, but if that were to be found out legally, are there any potential repercussions from something like that?
That's above my pay grade.
Above your pay grade?
I don't know. I don't know how that would be handled. I don't know if the title company at that point would be questioned. I don't know if it would be an issue. I don't know if they would dig deep enough into a seller's side of the statement. So, because none of that would show up on the buyer's closing disclosure. So, I mean, the whole thought of paying out contractors, right, from a title company perspective, I believe, and this is where you may need to get a title expert here, but, you know, their job is to make sure that the property is free of liens. So let's just say before they sold the property, they had work done and owed a contractor money, right? That could be, that's money that could be considered a lien on there. So I think that's where the gray area comes into play. That's probably a better question for a title company or a title agent, because I think that's where it gets gray, right? If there are contractors to be paid out. And look, from an investor standpoint and being on that side of things, I totally get why this is something that people want to do, right? It makes sense. I think it's great. From a lending perspective, so these people just have to remember, I don't think people really think about this, but there are real investors that buy these loans at the end of the day and that hold these loans and own these loans. And these people are like Wall Street, hedge fund people, insurance companies that buy these loans. So they're counting on these loans performing, and they're counting on these loans meeting the guidelines. They're counting on knowing what they're buying, right? And so when you start to get in, then there's reasons for some of these guidelines. So when you start to get into that, you know, if they start discovering that what they're buying isn't what they thought they were buying, then you start to get in a little bit into that 2008 territory. That's exactly what happened then, but different scenario, different problems then.
Yeah, I agree. Because essentially, seller credits, you're artificially pumping the price up. It's like, hey, this is really worth X, but I'm getting, you know, I'm getting money back. So look, it's not illegal to pay contractors through seller credits. I want to be clear on that. It's just a little, depending on what they're doing and everything. And then the type of contractor, I think, is important. And so for those listening, are seller credits bad? No, just be smart about it. And please don't pay yourself out of the seller credits, because that's where things get sketchy. And that's mortgage fraud. And there are legal repercussions from that. So, all right.
Yes.
Let's move on from that. And let's talk about subject to. We've talked about this before personally a lot.
Pepe's.
Yeah. What? So funny story real quick for our listeners. There was a retreat in Montana that Parker and I were both going to. And I'm in Buffalo. Parker, you live in Knoxville, right?
Tennessee. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tennessee. And I get on this flight to Dallas, this connection flight. And sure enough, I see Parker there. And I'm like, oh, hey, Parker. And I'm like, we'll check in my seat. And lo and behold, she was my sat right next to me the whole flight. So we didn't plan that. And we had a chance to catch up. And the subject two, we had a really interesting conversation on subject two. And I think I kind of want to like pick that up and take that back, because that obviously is really attractive, especially for a lot of investors who don't have a lot of funds. I can basically get someone to assign a property to me and take over their mortgage essentially and run it from there. My listeners know I'm not a big subject two fan from a short-term rental standpoint, because if they're sub twoing as a short-term rental, that means it doesn't make money. And they're trying, and they can't get their equity out of it, so they're trying to put that on somebody else. But that's not every property, but that's the majority of them I see. And it's just like this interest rate, oh, get all the sexy low interest rate trap. From a lending standpoint, are there risks for someone being assigned a mortgage? Let's start there.
Well, yeah, so legally, conventional loans, you can't assign a mortgage. They're not assumable. So you can't, whoever purchased the home and signed those mortgage docs, they're the ones that are in contract with the lender, right? So you can't just assign that to somebody else. There are VA and FHA are assumable loans. There's a process to go through for that. But conventional loans, and I'm not aware of any DSCR loans. There may be some that allow assumptions. I'm not aware of any. But yeah, most loans are not assumable loans. So to just assign something is not legally, you just can't really do it. So subject two is going to put you in a position where your loan could be called due. And this is where actually we can talk a little bit about the LLC thing here too, right? So I've actually taught attorneys this, which I'm very proud of, and given them the guidelines so they can interpret how they want. But so you can quit claim your property to an LLC. It is allowed through Fannie, Freddie, mostly their loan products, as long as you are in control of and or the majority owner of that LLC. You don't need permission. I get so many people that call and ask from like, you don't need permission. It's okay. Here are the guidelines. So you can quit claim a property to an LLC, not the mortgage, but the title to the property, as long as you are in control. So it comes back to the why, right? What these agencies don't want to happen is they don't want the ownership and debt to be split, right? So if you owe them the money, they would need you to have control of that property. And that's where it gets scary, when you owe the money but no longer have control of the property. So, yeah.
So how are these sub two guys getting away with it?
So I have not taken a suit. Well, number one, I'm not an attorney. number two, I haven't taken a super deep dive. I don't know that it's that they're getting away with it versus just not getting caught.
Bingo. Yeah. So that's exactly what I was going to say. I was like, I don't think they're not getting caught. But so can you break down, you're really good at this, and I can do it, but you're good at this too. So I want to give you the mic here. Can you break down how they're getting around the bank knowing about this assignment going from the original owner to themselves?
I don't know that there's a specific method. I really think it's just a matter of the fact that, so just because you change title to a property and put these contracts in place, there aren't any like alarm bells that go off for the servicing company or whoever owns the loan at that point.
Well, they don't even know. They don't know about it.
Right. They don't know about it. Exactly.
Yeah. They don't know about it. It doesn't trigger. So If you, that's why like quit claim deeding, with meaning basically like you take a property that's in your name on the deed and you put it into an LLC that's work done with the title company. The mortgage company doesn't know about that. And that's what you said earlier. And then with the sub two, it's kind of the same idea. It's like, this is being transferred to a new owner, essentially like assigned to a new owner. The mortgage company doesn't know about that.
Right. And what can happen, I mean, sometimes there can be a red flag. Sometimes there can be a red flag that'll flag them to look into it. And they do audit. Here's the thing, like people don't realize this, but they do audit loans and properties. We just had one come back the other day and I was very proud of this. They questioned occupancy. And here's the thing too, guys, if you're putting less than 20% down doing a conventional loan, guess who else audits it? The PMI companies audit these loans. Okay. More so than Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do. So you've got Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac auditing, you've got the lender, or they're required to audit a certain number. And you've got PMI companies auditing too, because they're the ones insuring that first 20%. This one was flagged by a PMI company.
So it was flagged. And sorry, tell the story of it. I'd love to hear it.
So we had a borrower, they bought a primary home. So they were living in Michigan and now they're going to live in Florida. And primary home purchase. And what flagged the company, this was like 10 months ago, we just got notified that they're looking into it now. And what flagged them was that on the insurance, there was loss of rent coverage on primary home insurance.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So now look, here's the deal. I'm very straightforward with my clients. I will dabble in the gray area. I will play in the gray area with you guys all day long. But if I know somebody's like trying to just blatantly commit mortgage fraud, like for example, buy a primary and use it not as a primary, but only for a short-term rental, I will tell clients, don't do that. No, I'm not afraid to do that. I'll say, look, buy it as a second home or investment, but don't buy it as a primary. But then I went back and looked at this file. This one was legit. Totally legit. And so then we found it. It's on Airbnb. But what I pointed out to the people investigating it, I said, look, it's only on Airbnb 3 months out of the year, like during the summer, the rest of the year it's blocked out because they're living there. So, you know, it's fine. It's totally fine to buy a primary home and rent it some, right? I think in their case, they were like going back to Michigan in the summers or what have you not, renting it out, making money, which is totally fine because they were primarily living there. And so, so that situation turned out to be totally fine. But I do want to point out, like, these things do get audited and they do pick up on them. So, you know, so that's where you could potentially, if you do a sub two, if they do audit, that's where this could come up and you could be in hot water.
So hot water being number one, they probably call the loan, right?
Correct. At least investigate it and then call the loan if necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. And what, anything else?
Well, and here's the deal too. Like I don't see this side of it. Like I'm not involved on the side where they would call the loan due. Because my question has always been, if they were to call the loan due, is there an effort that the owners could make and say, hey, we're sorry, we messed up. Let us fix this. Right. Get it back in our names. I don't know if that's a possibility, but then what happens to the people that purchase the property, right? And this is where the whole sub two things gets messy. And then what happens to the people that bought it?
Yeah, it's sketchy to say the least. So I think that if you're doing it, you need to be very careful and understand like what just the risks of it, what can happen. So I feel like there's a lot of people talking about each of these topics, but they're not talking about the risks associated with them as well. It's just easily I can do this. And you have to be really, really careful because these things can be investigated. And going back to the seller credit thing, I mean, they can be investigated and it's considered mortgage fraud, which is federal crime, which warrants jail time. Like that's pretty scary. And it's not like...
Yeah.
And it's not, oh, someone took $5,000. You know, it's these ones where you see people like $50,000, $100,000, you know, and then people are getting that money in their name, or they're just somehow getting the money and these investigators are figuring it out. You got to be really careful. because that there's a lot of the fear of 2008 happening again is very, very real, and there are a lot of investors, a lot of banks, big investors, big banks, trying to make sure that doesn't happen again. So just be cautious.
100%.
All right, I want to go move from this to some positive things. So now that we got over the controversy, which I appreciate you diving in and being open and sharing, let's talk about the LLC side. I talk to a lot of investors who come to me, maybe for their first property or even their second property, who are like, hey, I want to buy a property in an LLC for asset protection purposes. Okay. Now, I know you're not an attorney. I'm not asking you about the asset protection side, but they're thinking like, if I get sued, you know, all this other stuff. And I get that. But there's some lending ramifications if you buy in an LLC, meaning like there's just different loan products. So what are the differences in the loan products, and why might it be beneficial and also not beneficial to buy in an LLC?
Definitely. So, and there's two different things to keep in mind here. One is the title of the property in the LLC, and the other is the mortgage being in the name of the LLC. So one misconception to clear up on the mortgage piece of it being in the LLC is that in 99% of the cases, somebody's going to have to personally guarantee that note. So it's not 100%, like you're not off the hook for the mortgage just because it's in the name of the LLC. You've got to personally guarantee it. Because I think there's a lot of people that think, oh, if I get in the LLC and something happens, then I'm free and clear, which is not how that works. And then, of course, there's the title to the property. So the only products, again, there may be some commercial products at some commercial banks, but when we talk about like residential lending products, so even DSCR, I think a lot of people call it a commercial loan, but it's not. It's still a residential loan product. It's not a commercial bank loan. It's still a residential product. So you can vest and have the mortgage in the name of the LLC on DSCR products. I also have access to the full doc or the bank statement, the full doc, those other lines. I can close those now in an LLC as well. But those are the only two products. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because some people say, hey, I work for Movement Mortgage. I've got my team is with Movement Mortgage. So they'll say, hey, what are Movement's rules on? It's like, well, it's not Movement's rules. It's if you're doing a conventional loan, it's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's rules. And they, you can only close in a trust or in your personal name for them. Now, as far as ramifications go, you know, there are a few things to look out for. And this is something that, again, I've really paid close attention to over the years because I've had clients who closed in an LLC. So these properties will still show up typically in these background reports that we run. So as lenders, we run these background reports. And that's where, so Kenny, have you ever had like a lender ask you about an address you lived at when you were like five? You're like, why is this relevant? Well, because it showed up somewhere on this background report, so we just have to ask about it. I know it's annoying. But that's where sometimes some of these properties you may have closed in an LLC will even pop up. So like I had one once and I was like, okay, well, I need to get a copy of the note to show it's in the financing's not in your name, that it's in the LLC. Because the whole whether it reports on credit or not is not what determines if something counts against you. What determines if a mortgage payment counts against your debt to income ratio is whose name that note's in. And so in this particular scenario, the note was in both the names of the LLC and the individual. So on the signature line, they were signing as an individual and as a member of that LLC. And so because of that, they hadn't met the 12-month payment rule. So because of that, we had to count that debt against them. So when Movement started doing this, and I will say we've got some great leadership at Movement and they're really great about listening to me. So I really appreciate that. So I said, hey guys, when we start doing this in LLCs, we can't, like the whole purpose of this is to help kind of protect their debt to income ratio and to keep this in the name of the LLC. So we've got to make sure that the way we set up the documents and the paperwork, it's not both of them signing. It's them signing on half of the LLC and also stating that they'll be a personal guarantor. And so we've done that. And there's a lot out there that are set up that way, but I did pick up because that caused a wrench. We still got that one closed, that particular situation I was talking about, but it did cause some challenges there. And so it's like some of the stuff gets a little bit tricky, but this is also why you need to work with somebody who understands how this all works, if that makes sense.
100%. Yeah. So it gets a lot trickier when you start involving LLCs. And something important too is I remind people all the time, your lending options get smaller, right? Like you just mentioned, like the conventional loans are, you know, they're out. if your situation calls to put a property in LLC, then I get it. But a lot of times it doesn't. You know, and there are other products out there. It's just you need to talk to a competent lender who understands each of these individual types of loans that you can do and weigh the pros and cons. Because a lot of times, I mean, I know this, like those loans with an LLC, they're going to be a little bit more pricier. You know, the terms aren't going to be as great. Because they're considered a little riskier. So, I'm not sure why, but they just are. So you just don't get a good term. So it's like, are you going to sacrifice that for, you know, a false sense of asset protection?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Cause I talk to a lot of clients that call me and say they want DSCR. I always say, hey, I'm happy to do DSCR all day long or closing an LLC for you, but you might want to know your other options too. Right. And I get all the time, I want to protect, there's a big thing going around. I want to protect my debt to income ratio. Like when do we, because then we're going to max out our debt to income ratio. Well, here's the thing, like the debt to income ratio is a fluid calculation. So first of all, there's not one way to do it because it depends on which loan product you're doing, like we talked about earlier. Number two, I think people forget you're going to have rental income. You know, so you buy a couple of properties this year, they're going to be on your tax return next year. And maybe the numbers don't look wonderful then because you bought a ton of furniture and you didn't get seller credits. Just kidding.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah, to bring that up. So maybe the numbers don't look fantastic, but then the year after that, they should look great. And that should not only knock out the calculation, should not only knock out that mortgage payment, but hopefully it gives you some positive additional income towards your debt to income ratio. So it's like someone asked me yesterday, when will we max out our debt to income ratio? And I was like, well, I mean, you may not ever max it out because of that ebb and flow of you purchase, you have the rental income, then you purchase, you have the rental income. And I think people forget about that.
Yeah, no, they do. And I think that if you're thinking about purchasing, you need to be talking to a lender now. Because I think that the conversations like this, they can sit down and look at your situation and say, you know, and another thing too, like, you know, when I was prepping to buy a primary residence, you know, they're like, hey, you should probably really, really try to protect your DTI and consider DSCR loans because you're trying to buy a primary residence for the next year and you're not going to get the tax returns in time before you buy your primary. Therefore, protect your DTI. But then they're like, if you wait, then, you know, it doesn't matter because you're going to get those tax returns, that rental income, like you're talking about. And so I think when you're thinking about buying, it's always a good time to go ahead and engage with a lender or two and understand your situation and create the plan. You know, I think people wait, like I found a property, now I need to talk to a lender, which is like a big no-no. And right. Then smarter people will talk to a lender when they're like, okay, I know I need to get pre-approved and everything. But then like the genius people, the intelligent people are talking to lender way before they even, you know, start hunting and knowing what they're going to do and they're mapping everything out. So what do you say? Do you agree with that? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
1000%. We should be part of the strategy in the beginning so that you know, because it's hard to map out and plan what you're going to do if you don't know what the possibilities are and what you can do. You know, I have so many people sell themselves short and not realize they can qualify for so much or understand the products. I had one yesterday that called me, thought we had to go the DSCR route, but then I opened his eyes up to some lower down payment options that he could qualify for. And he's like, you're the first lender that's ever, usually when I call and say DSCR, they say, okay, let's do it. And you're the first one that's ever taken the time to explain to me how I could qualify for these other loan options with lower rates and lower down payments. And so, but to your point, mapping that out early on to build your strategy, I think is so important.
Well, yeah. Parker, I think we're coming to the end here. This has been really, really helpful. Lots of good content. I've learned a lot. I hope that people listening have feel a little bit better about understanding some of these hot topics. Just understand to be careful. It's not necessarily like you cannot do these things. Just understand what the risks are. You know, and understand too what the lending options are, and speaking to a lender and you know, being smart about that process. As we're kind of wrapping up here, Parker, what's one like final nugget? Shows cash flow positive. It can be about lending, it can be about anything else. You're an SDR operator. What's one nugget or a piece of information you love to give people to help them cash flow positive with their SDRs?
I have so many, Kenny.
That's it.
I would just want to remind people, I think my nugget, because I just see people sell themselves short so much and limit their own options. Please don't DIY your DTI.
Okay. Yeah.
That's my nugget. Like, I want you guys to talk to a couple lenders, get some different options and insight into your actual situation, because some of you may find that you can do even more than you thought you could.
How are lenders' sentiment towards DSCR loans with using SDR data today?
Good question. So, you know, I think they've always been a little more hesitant than long-term rent. And, you know, it's interesting though, is that it's not necessarily because, like, we know because we're short-term rental investors, right? So we know it works. But you have to understand that people buying these, again, are like these Wall Street people. They don't understand short-term rental income. And when they don't understand something, they fear it.
Mm.
And so that's why there's a little more hesitancy. And also, I think it's harder for them to know that the data they're getting is solid, because they also don't understand, well, where are these projections coming from? How does anybody know? Which, that's your specialty, Kenny. I'm sure you could have a great conversation with them to break sure. that down, you know, but at their level, they're like, how does anybody even know? Right. And so they don't understand it. So there's a little more fear of the short-term rental income. What's happening right now also with the state of the economy just being kind of in flux with the tariffs and the bond market, which took a huge hit last week. You know, I think there's some concern there that we may be going into a recession. And so I have seen we've got a couple DSCR products that offer short-term rental that we can use short-term rental income on. And one of them's kind of up their pricing on it a bit. The other one's kind of pulling back and adding a few more guideline restrictions on it. So they're just kind of being cautious, because I think they don't know how it's going to react. So in this case, though, this is where you definitely want to be in line with a lender who can help and navigate and kind of go with other products. So for example, the full doc non-QM product I mentioned, where we can go different routes with that so that you don't have to do DSCR. So there's some people that are going to be in a situation where they have to go DSCR. There's just no other option to qualify. But for those out there who might have other options, I would recommend just keeping those options open, because it may help you navigate the next, you know, few months or year, however long it takes to get whatever's going on settled down. Going. So yeah. So just be open to other ways to purchase properties.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you. That's awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, as we're kind of concluding here, Parker, what's the best way that people can get in touch with you? And if they're interested in speaking with you about your loan products or your services?
Absolutely. If you go to wealthbuildersmortgage.com, on that screen there. Ta-da. And so wealthbuildersmortgage.com, my Calendly link is on there. That's the easiest way to get in touch with me. You can also reach out through social media. I'm on Facebook. I do try to answer my messenger pretty quickly. So yeah, so feel free to reach out, set up time on my Calendly, or reach out there and I can send you the Calendly link. But yeah, that's the easiest way to get a hold of us.
If you want to talk to the one, the only, the short-term rental loan genie, mortgage genie, then you can get her Calendly link, ask for three wishes, whatever. It's wealthbuildersmortgage.com.
Yes.
So if you're listening on the drive there. So anyway, well, Parker, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this episode. I thought it was really good, helpful, lots of good information. Awesome. Thanks for joining us. And I hope our listeners enjoyed it. And I will see everybody on the next episode of Cashflow Positive.
Thanks, Kenny.